This is The Job. I'm Ray. I'm here with Candace. It is May 8th, 2014. Welcome back to the program. Today's guest is Jim Brown, publisher of Atomic Ranch magazine, Mid-Century Marvels. But first, let's just catch everyone up. I apologize for my voice today. I have a cold, very persistent cold I've had all week. It sucks. I had to miss a day, and I hate missing a day of work. What else is new?
What else is new? Gosh, Atomic Ranch, this is their 10-year anniversary.
Yes, we have the issue right in front of us.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it seems like I've seen that magazine forever. It's been one of those little gems that's hard to find. It certainly means a lot more to me now that I own a house, or since we've owned a house, you know. Mm-hmm.
1950s.
Right.
Ranch.
Yeah. So it's eye candy.
Yeah. This was when, so when we bought our house, there was about a 2-month period where we were living in quite a small loft waiting for the house to be available. Mm-hmm. And I poured over, this magazine became my Bible. It was like I would pour over it and dream about where we were going to be living. And there were nights where I would take, some 2-3-year-old edition, and I would research every product in it that I loved. And I have these a lot of Pinterest boards were made after reading Atomic Ranch and just dreaming and
tinkering. Yeah, it's definitely Pinterest fodder there.
Well, and I hope their advertisers realize that because, I was oftentimes looking at, straight at these ads and designs and, researching all of it.
Yeah.
It's and the thing that I really love about this magazine is that these aren't perfect houses. Like, these are not people that are going and spending their life savings at Design Within Reach or wherever.
Sure.
These are folks that are scouring estate sales and slowly putting together these spaces that they care about and then talking about it. And one of the things that reminded me is that you don't need to have everything all at once. Some of the stories in here are, 30 years of putting your home together, and that's really inspiring to me after moving into a house that's, feels halfway empty, even though we're there now. There's this feeling where you want to move in and just fill it. Someone came over the other day and said, looked around and basically said, "Hey, you just moved in. This place is going to look great in 5 years," because it's bare.
Yeah.
There are rooms where there are, three pieces of furniture. And I feel like
wires hanging out of the ceiling.
Yeah, that's a sore spot, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So,
oops.
What happened? The day we moved in, I personally pulled down some lights from the ceiling that were atrocious and declared that we would have no lights until we pick some out, and it's been 4 months. It's really hard to pick just the right light,
Yeah.
It's summer's coming up, so I feel like we actually have until September or October. It's only the kitchen. Maybe this latest edition of Atomic Ranch will give us some ideas. It's their Spring 14 10th anniversary issue. So,
in the web design world, just kidding.
What?
I'm just kidding. Oh yeah. You know what? Why don't we talk to Jim?
Okay, sounds good.
So I'm here talking to Jim Brown, editor of Atomic Ranch Magazine. Is that your job title?
No, actually, I'm publisher photographer.
Okay.
My wife is the editor.
Okay. So you are coming up on your 10-year anniversary. That's exciting. Before we get to that, though, I'm curious, where are you originally from?
Originally Southern California.
Okay. How did you end up in Minnesota? How did you end up in Oregon?
It was back, we moved up in 2000, Jesus Christ, 2006 is when we came up here.
Okay.
We had started the magazine, it was going successful, and Michelle had always wanted to leave Southern California,
mm-hmm.
and I grew to agree with her.
Right.
And we were in basically Pasadena, which is the east side of L.A., and it gets terribly hot. It's always smoggy. We'd been there all our lives. It's crowded. Even though our families were there, we said, let's get the heck out of here. And she wanted someplace green and wet and liberal, and we made it to Portland.
Yeah.
Just in time.
Rings a bell.
Yeah.
Okay, you had started the magazine before moving here? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Southern California, you know, it's a hotbed of modernism.
Right.
And it's got Palm Springs, and there's just modern tracks all over the place. It's an ideal place to start this magazine for subject matter.
Right.
But then also, after a while, we realized, well, it's a national magazine. We're not tied into Southern California. In fact, readers want to see homes in other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, through the magic of electronics, you could work anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided, what the hell, we're going to pull up stakes and go.
Okay.
And, you know, it was at the height of the housing market. We could sell, and, you know, values were much greater here in Portland, and we couldn't be happier to be here.
Mm-hmm. Is it, so it sounds like it hasn't been, that would have actually been my first question, like, was it a challenge? So it sounds like it wasn't that difficult for what you do to be here.
Yeah, we weathered it, you know.
Do you do a lot of travel?
I do some travel.
Okay.
Since I'm the publisher, I do all the covers.
Okay.
And so I could go out on a trip and shoot three or four houses, and that we're set for the whole year because it's a quarterly.
Okay.
So I've got a backlog now of five or six homes that are in the can, ready to go, just in the schedule. And everything else is contributions from people around the country.
Mm-hmm.
They're either interested homeowners or they're architects or builders or developers that say, hey, look at my place. What do you think? And, you know, all you need is text and images.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty easy to do these days. In the old days, it would be impossible. You'd have to travel all over. But now people just send in stuff. You know, it's pretty easy to develop editorial content.
Yeah. So it's definitely, like, it sounds like the magazine is more of a collaboration, really, with you and the readers to some extent.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a lot of the content is reader-generated. I mean, mm-hmm. really reader-generated. It's not just inspired by the readers, but they actually send in their stuff. You know, this is what I did to my bathroom, mm-hmm. or I got historical status for my neighborhood. What do you think? And it's, okay, take some pictures. Give us the bare bones idea, and we'll work it into a story.
Was it hard at first?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, because at first you kind of have to prove yourself, and imagine you didn't really have those contributions. Or
no, the first couple of, you know, the first issue, all the ads were free.
Uh huh.
We just tried to convince people that it looked nice, make it look nice in the magazine.
Right.
And most of the content was generated by me and Michelle. All the product photography, all the reviews, and that kind of thing. But eventually, people started to contribute. First contributions were what we call our homepage, which is people take a snapshot of their house, you know, in Ohio. They say, I just moved here. I love it. Here's the picture of my house. And you get three of those, and you got a homepage feature.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm a collector of Murano glass. So, okay, get some good pictures of Murano glass and write up your story, send it in, and, you know, there's another story.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it coalesced with us after a while. It was a struggle at first,
mm-hmm.
but it has gained steam, and with distribution and readership, you know, we get a lot of email contributions all the time.
Yeah. Do you, is it, like, how would you describe your audience, your target audience? Is it, it's not really, like, you're not, like, the type of magazine that would, you're not, like, telling people how to build things. It's more kind of sharing, maybe, would you say, inspiration, or?
Yeah, readers' stories, their travails of finding a house, fixing up a house, trying to convince a realtor that this is what I'm looking for. I don't want this kind of thing. I want this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's our readership is.
I bet you get a lot of people showing realtors this magazine.
Yeah, I think so.
Sometimes it can be hard to explain. I have a realtor in the family who was curious what an Atomic Ranch was. I was like, how could you not know that you're a realtor? You know.
But they don't. They don't get the concept.
Yeah.
You know, they...
And she knows what a ranch is.
Yeah, she knows what a ranch is.
So what would you tell her? What is an atomic ranch?
The height of an atomic ranch, to me, design-wise, is an Eichler, or up here in Portland, it'd be a Rummer.
Okay.
It's got really thin walls, pitched roofs. It has clear-story windows. Those are the top things on this, on your walls. Mm-hmm. Windows on top of your walls. Those are clear stories. It's got open floor plan. The front room and the dining room and the kitchen all kind of flow together. It's got a huge characteristic of ranches is that the front face to the public is usually extremely modest. Sometimes you can't even see where the front door is. You know, it's just almost like a barricade.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get inside and it's all opened up, and in from the inside, you go to the back outside, the backyard, and you have walls of sliding glass doors. And so you have flipped this the concept around that it's very private outside, and you save all your energy for inside or your backyard with your family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're built to house the GIs after the war. So it's 1950 to 1970. Tracks, custom homes.
So was it typically like a pragmatic aesthetic? Was it, I mean, when you're talking about people post-war, was it something where they could build a lot of them cheaply at the time?
Yes, a lot of them cheaply. And entrepreneur builders or builder merchants is what the term is. They, you know, get a tract of land, get a bulldozer, and they'd start building houses. And some of the forward-thinking builders would go to architects and see what they were doing and incorporate architectural details into their tracks, because they wanted to, since they were repeating these floor plans, you know, all the time on their tract, they had to think of ways to make each home a little bit individual. So they would flip them, they would reverse them, they would have like five different designs.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these guys, for further individuality or to distinguish their tract from someone else, they went for these modern features that were coming out of California or back east from the universities and the architectural departments.
Mm-hmm.
So these features were post and beam construction, walls of glass, open floor plan, clear story windows, that kind of thing. And those things, when they incorporated them into their homes, they made them distinctive from the competition.
Mm-hmm.
And that today is the things that we celebrate.
Yeah. Is it is Portland a good place to see Atomic Ranch housing?
It's pretty good. It's got a lot of good ranches on the west side.
Mm-hmm.
On the east side, you'll find pockets of ranches.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to think of it in as a historian that, okay, the Victorians laid down their houses, and then the arts and crafts people laid down their houses. And, okay, so that brings you up to the 50s, what land was open and available.
Gotcha.
So then you go, okay, so you go into a ranch tract. Well, this is obviously farmland until 1950,
mm-hmm.
and someone came in and built it. Now, where I live, East Moreland, it's predominantly arts and crafts homes from the 1920s, but from in certain blocks, there will have been open pieces of land, and in the 50s, a developer came in and in these little plots of land, In between the arts and crafts homes, he would build a ranch. But other places are, when they're a tract, they're all consistently ranches, and mm-hmm. that's when a developer came in and put down like 200 homes mm-hmm. In a plop.
Hmm. Well, this is a good time for this interview, because I honestly wouldn't have really been thinking about this, but as we mentioned before we were talking, we just moved into a house just like this in kind of in the same part of town as you.
Yeah, you're not very close to us.
Yeah. What can you tell us about your house? Is there anything really cool about the one that you're in?
We love it. we walked. You know, we came up. We had a realtor, Alyssa Storelli.
Okay.
And she showed us. We came up for one, like two or three days, and we, you know, saw a bunch of houses, and they're all arts and crafts. And like on the last day, we rolled up to this particular house. It was a ranch, and we walked in and. You know, it's always the same story we hear from people. You walk in, you take one look, and say, yeah, this is the house. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what it was for us. You know, big windows, great view, open floor plan. And so our house, it was built in 1952. I would call it a transitional ranch. It has some of the elements of what you'd call a traditional ranch. Clapboard siding. It has a brick facade. It has a hip roof. But also it has, making it transitional, it has an open floor plan, wood floors. The entire front end is huge panes of glass looking out on the street. You know, we're really exposed. You know, you see the kids go to school every day. The bus goes by our house every day. But it's incredible views out there. If you get beyond the public nature of the place, it's just a joy to live there. Mm-hmm. When the sun comes out and you're looking down the street and the trees are blooming or green, it's just fabulous. So a traditional kitchen, regular bathrooms and bedrooms, nice basement. But I call it a transitional ranch.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's a transitional ranch, then something like a rummer would be like the ultimate expression of a tract ranch house.
Okay.
You know, really wild architecture, very thin and spare, very clean lines.
So what do you tend to try to populate a ranch, like a mid-century ranch with like that kind of, like furniture that would have been contemporaneous, like Eames kind of
Eames
things.
Chairs, yeah.
I mean, that's kind of in the photos you often see that type of stuff.
It's a cliche, but yeah. It sure works.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to know historically that the people who originally occupied these homes did not have the modern furniture that we love. They probably brought in their stuff from the 30s or the 20s or,
true.
You know, old antiques or Ethan Allen kind of thing, and they probably loved it, or Chinese or whatever. But to me, a ranch really sings when it has the furniture from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And it becomes a cliche. It's almost you could order it out of a catalog, but... God damn it! Sure looks good.
Very, very nice guy.
It sure looks good.
Yeah. Now, what do you think caused the end of this type of housing, or did there, was there an end, or was it just a demographic change or suburbs?
They became so ubiquitous, and there are a lot of, you know, unremarkable ranches out there. And I think the unremarkable ranches overwhelmed the really great ranches. And it's a style. And every style goes through a cycle that it's really hot and that's really not. And then it comes back and it's hot again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think America just moved on. America and the builders moved on. They wanted to go bigger. They were distracted by other styles. People wanted... a feeling of greater comfort or to show their wealth,
mm-hmm.
you know. So And then another thing for the unpopularity of ranch, classic ranch styles, is that they take up a lot of land. They typically have a big backyard, and they kind of sprawl. And so land became more valuable. So, you know, ranches fell out of favor for all those reasons.
So it sounds like you... So when I think of a magazine publisher, first the word mogul comes to mind, but also like a bustling newsroom with the sound of teletypes in the background and so forth. But I'm guessing that's not how Atomic Ranch is run.
Yeah. See, I came from a magazine empire, Peterson Publishing.
Okay.
And Hot Rod, Motor Trend, Motorcycle Magazine. And I worked there for 17 years as a photographer. So I got to see what the editors and publishers were like and the art directors. And yeah, publishers in that environment are the top ad salesmen. They're, you know, cigars, whiskey, take the guys out, travel, glad hand the advertisers, make them happy, raise hell with the editor when the editor says something crappy about a product. And that is a classic publisher, and that's not me.
Right.
That is not me. You know, I am at core, I'm the photographer.
Okay.
And it's just that when we started the business, Michelle was obviously going to be the editor, and well, okay, who's going to be the publisher? Okay, I guess I'll be it. So, you know, publisher's next to my name, but I am not a, you know, what the concept of a publisher is not me.
Right. But did that experience, I assume, helped?
Oh, absolutely.
Helped you think about putting out a magazine of
your own? That's why that we did it, because it was a business that we knew. She worked at American Bungalow, and I worked at Peterson.
Okay.
So we knew people that we could ask questions, and we could hire our art director from Peterson and that kind of thing. So when we had questions, we knew people to talk to, and it was a business that we were familiar with. We didn't know it as well as we do now, but, you know, it felt, oh, yeah, we could do this.
Right. Do you have a preferred camera that you're shooting with when you're taking
The Canon. Okay. I got a D5, and I got some perspective lenses, you know.
Okay.
I've got a kit that I go out and, you know, good tripod. So yeah, when we started it, I was shooting film, RB67, you know, 2.25 film. And then eventually the digital became good enough that you could do a double page spread on a digital frame. And then keep the camera home, because you were just shooting so much to try to get your color balance and bracketing and all that kind of stuff. And it's a bigger camera. So it was nice to go digital.
Do you, when people are submitting things for the magazine, do you put out advice on what they should shoot with, or is it just
my job has turned into coaching amateur photographers.
Okay. Makes sense.
You know, and it's they're enthusiastic, they have their house, and
they've got the subject matter.
And I say, okay, this is what we need. This is what you when they send you a picture, you can see what camera they have and their exposures and f-stop and all that kind of stuff. So then I look at that, I analyze it, and I go back to them and I say, okay, turn your camera to manual, turn off the flash. Do you know anyone that owns a tripod? If you don't have a tripod, do you have a step ladder? You know, do you have a self timer? Put it on self timer, walk away, it'll take the picture. You know, look very carefully at the LCD. Is that a picture you really like? And then download it to your computer. Do not put it through any editing program, because they will reduce it down to 72 DPI. And I want a full size file. The biggest file you could possibly send me is what I want. And don't mess with it. I'll mess with it. So, yeah, I'm constantly coaching these amateur photographers.
Yeah, I could see that.
And you know, they're really enthusiastic. They work their ass off on it. Mm-hmm. Some people work for like a year taking pictures of their house and sending it to us. And we say, okay, move a little bit over here or try this or, you know, close the drapes, see what happens. And eventually they get something that is, you know, publishable. And our art director is really good at making silk purses out of sow's ears.
That's a lovely turn of phrase. So this is the 10th anniversary right here?
It is.
Ooh, indeed. Just the cover.
Just the cover.
Is it going to be like a double double album?
No, we tried. we had visions of a gatefold, but it wasn't flying with the advertisers, so we just went to this.
Is there anything you're super excited about that's coming up here in the?
It's a fabulous house. This cover house is in Eichler, which is my all-time favorite tract. He did a fabulous job of restoring it. A lot of people, they will gut an interior and put in all new stuff, but he spent a ton of money and time getting materials that are appropriate. Like, he got burlap for the walls. You know, like you have burlap on your walls right here, mm-hmm. but Eichler's have grass cloth or burlap covering some of their walls. So he was trying to, you know, restore his Eichler, and you can't get burlap anymore. So, or the right kind of burlap.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to get it from India.
Wow.
You know, and it's probably cheap fabric, but he wanted this thing. Or it has mahogany paneling. And Eichler's had Luan paneling throughout their homes, you know, as a typical characteristic. But today, if you get Luan, you have to get not the cheap stuff that they make boxes out of, or not the really beautiful mahogany, but you have to get the mid-grade Luan. And you have to lightly sand it, and you have to lightly stain it. And sometimes it takes a stain, and sometimes it doesn't. So these are all the trials that this guy went through to get this perfect, you know, reconditioned mm-hmm. Eichler. And he happens to also own, there's a very famous house, a Neutra house in Palm Springs called the Kaufman House.
Okay.
He's the owner of that one also. So he had a lot of resources to do a really fabulous job.
Sure.
Or like in the kitchen, the countertops are laminate. And most people today, if they're redoing their kitchen and spending a zillion or have a huge budget like he does, they're going to go with granite or stainless or some beautiful stone. But he kept true to the Eichler ethos, and he sought out laminate, which is not hard to find. And it's a cheaper alternative, and it's a correct material to use. And so he kept the integrity of his house, and I really admire that.
Yeah. Where is that house? What
part it's in Orange County, Southern California.
Okay.
It's one of the last tracts of Eichler's down there. There are three tracts of Eichler's in Southern California and a whole bunch in Northern California, which is where Eichler originated. But the weird thing is I drove or flew down for this job to shoot the house, and I'm driving to it and turned the corner onto the tract, and I'm in my car and I'm like, oh, hey, look. There's the house I shot in 2008 for the cover. And, oh, wait, that one over there. I did that in 2000. And look at that one. That's so-and-so's. And they're all within, like, two blocks of each other. Mm-hmm. And this is the fourth one in that neighborhood that I've shot, and they've all attained, you know, cover status.
Wow.
So it's a hell of a development right there.
Mm-hmm. If someone is a, say you're in Portland, or, I mean, Portland is an example because we are. And if you wanted to go around and see some of these houses firsthand and just get an idea of what you're talking about, what you're excited about, is there like an event where you get to see those houses or
a
neighborhood that would be good to start from?
There are home tours that come. There's Historical Society of they do a home tour.
Okay.
Actually, coming up, geez, I wish I had the specific information. There is a home tour coming up of Piero Berlucci's homes. There's like four or five in this tour. Last time they did a tour of Zeiss, some other architect. They find an architect and they get homes by the architect and they put on a tour and they're always sold out.
That's cool. Who does that?
I wish I can't get the name. It's, you know, it's in the back of my head, but I can't bring it up right now.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
It's usually what we do with things we can't remember.
I'll email it to you.
Cool. That'd be great. Yeah.
Yeah. But so that would be a way to look at homes. Predominantly, I think they're on the west side of Portland. Mm-hmm. There are Rummers, which are pretty much duplicates of Eichler's. They're over in the Oak Mills area, Oak Hills, Cedar Hills, Cedar Mills, something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know Portland as well as I should, mm-hmm. but there are Rummers out there. You'll find a neighborhood, and there'll be, because he didn't consistently build that style everywhere, he'd go into a tract, and there'd be a modernist Rummer, and then a regular-looking tract house, and then a modernist Rummer, and they're all kind of interspersed together. But there's a pretty good concentration out there. It's just not it's house after house after house. They're interspersed.
I see.
And actually, OPB Radio is doing a next Thursday. They're an interview with Mr. Rummer, Robert Rummer, who's still alive.
Whoa.
And they've invited me to attend. I don't know if they're going to speak or not, but Rummer is going to be the featured guest. He's still alive. He's happy for the publicity. And it's a track that has just gained historical status by the work of a woman named Darla Castagna.
That's so great.
Yeah, she's really enthusiastic. And, she's...
Does he live in Portland?
Rummer? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Or Portland, this area.
This area.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Here's issue one.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's crazy.
Here's issue, 40.
Uh-huh.
So what I brought today is a copy of our very first issue, number one, and the press proof of issue 41, which is our 10th anniversary. So they're right here.
Just we gotta we'll put a photo of those side by side in the show notes. That's great.
Yeah.
Wow. And
so this was a house in our first cover. Got up in the morning, and my van had a flat tire. It was packed full of gear, and I had to put in the Space Saver tire and then get out to the location to shoot it. So it's kind of a hair-raising thing. You're all psyched up to go through the shoot. Oh, I got a flat.
You think you've got another 10 years of this?
Oh yeah, easy. There's so much out there.
Sounds like you have you line it up pretty well in advance, which is really helpful. So it's not so stressful.
We're at least a year ahead.
Oh great.
Which is kind of tough for the homeowners, because you photograph their house and they wait and wait and wait and wait.
Right. They're telling their friends, and their friends are like, "Nah, I don't believe it's going to be in the magazine." Like
a year later or 2 years later. Oh, right. There they are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can relate to that. We record these ahead a little bit.
Sure.
So what advice would you give to someone who wanted to start a magazine of a real subject area like yours? Like, what have you learned in 10 years about doing this?
Worth
it?
Oh yeah, it's rejuvenated our marriage.
Okay.
It's provided us with lots of fun and obviously employment, and it was a shelter from the recession for us.
Yeah.
We no longer had to freelance. It was our occupation. Mm-hmm. So we made our own occupation, which is good. My advice, it's a love, but it's also a business. And, where's your income going to come in? How are you going to print it? How are you going to get it out there? Are you going to go electronic? Are you going to go ink and paper? Are you going to do both? Basic questions of how are you going to get your little baby out there, and how are you going to sustain it? Mm-hmm. Are you going to look for advertising? Are you going to be subscriber-based? Are you going to be newsstand? Where's your money going to come in from? Those are the questions you have to ask. And are you regional or national? Are you local? What are your aims? You know, and then it's hooking up with the right experts for all those, the answers to all those questions. If you wanted to do homes, there's always, you know, people are always going to be in their, our basic thing was people are always going to be in their homes. They're going to love their home. It's their major investment. And they will want to know about it. They'll want to fix it up. And it's just a, you know, it's a whole, it's the category called shelter magazines. And, you know, you go to Powell's, and there's a whole thing of shelter magazines. And that's what it is, from Architectural Digest to Atomic Ranch. And in between, there's log cabins, Victorians, all kinds of styles. You know, eventually, one of these days, there will be a magazine about McMansions. You know, my marvelous McMansion.
Right.
You know, in 20 or 30 years, they're going to be really desirable.
Isn't that weird? It's probably so true, though.
It's true, because it's a cycle.
Yeah.
You know?
Someday everyone of those homes will be, like, you know, tiny and weird, and they'll be like, remember when our houses were huge?
Gigantic, and had a great room that we never used.
Yeah.
It was two stories tall.
Right.
And we had a kitchen that we never used. We worked on a hot plate, but we had this fabulous kitchen with, you know, 8 burner stoves.
That's funny. You know, I would say, like, one of the biggest challenges, and this is just kind of on a personal level, when you get a house like that, it's like, maybe it's a personal choice, but where do you find the balance between really trying to go completely vintage and, like, putting up a television on the wall, or like, maybe you want a fancy new Nest thermostat, but that is clearly not vintage.
Yeah, it's tough. It is a dilemma. And I think technically, one of these days, someone's going to invent the invisible TV on the wall that, you know, when you're not watching, it's no longer disappears.
That's true.
But currently, I don't know. You put it into a TV room. You don't put it out in the front. You don't make it the focus of your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we resisted for a while, but we eventually got a big screen TV, and it's wonderful. You know,
sure, exactly. You know,
it's really fun.
Yeah,
but it can dominate the room, and it's this big black rectangle somewhere. Yep,
pretty much.
And like this guy, the Eichler for the 10th anniversary, he hides it behind a cabinet.
Yeah.
But then you got this cabinet there that is just sticking there, and it's kind of in a little family room. So yeah, the desire to get the nice new stuff, how does it fit into your mid-century home? It's a dilemma, you know.
Maybe like a refrigerator. What is it?
Oh, refrigerators are easy. They're expensive, but they're easy. You could either get a refurbished old refrigerator.
Okay.
They're still out there. They still work. Or there are a couple companies that currently make brand new refrigerators in the mid-century style.
Oh, wow.
So if you have the bucks, you can do that, and I think it's money well spent.
Yeah.
There's Big Chill, there's Elmira, we have a thing called a Mueller. There's a couple of refrigerators out there that are in that style.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they just slip right in, and they look perfect, and they're brand new modern. Yeah, so it's a tough decision to make.
Well, let me ask you, Jim, a personal question about those kinds of choices. This is something that I've always wondered about. Companies like Design Within Reach make what are clearly sort of reissues of stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
Table that we're at, for those who cannot see me right now because there's no camera here. But it's not, you know, this is not a vintage chair or table. Is it wrong to put those in your home if you have a vintage, you know, Atomic Ranch?
No, okay. I don't think so.
Okay.
There are people who are collectors and vintage experts, and part of the joy of their life is going to vintage stores or flea marts or things like that and finding the true vintage piece of furniture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it gives them great joy, and they research it, and there's a whole hierarchy of value.
Mm-hmm.
like this was the first edition of the chair. You'll notice that the grommets are square. Later on, Mr. Eames, they changed to round grommets because of easier manufacturing. But this one's got the square one, so it is extra, extra cool and extra valuable. Well, great. Mm-hmm. You know, go to it. Have a lot of fun. I'm glad you like that stuff. Me, personally, I'm much more at ease buying new manufactured items of the vintage, the mid-century furniture. Mm-hmm. That there's an ick factor involved when you get vintage. Like, who sat in this chair before? You know, who threw up on this chair? Do I really want to bring that into my house?
Yeah.
And some people say, yeah, bring it in. And me, I'd rather have something fresh and new, but is still an authentic design, mm-hmm. a Saarinen table. Got it, and it's in our front room, but it's newly made, but it's an authentic Saarinen. Uh-huh. And you know, the traditionalists will say, well, that's just like a car. You buy the car, and its value has plummeted when you take it out of the box. That Saarinen chair that I bought is, you know, worth a pittance of what you purchased it for. Uh-huh. And I say, I don't care. I got what I want. I got the lines that I want. I got the look that I want. Yes, it was manufactured last year, but it's still what I wanted, and it looks great. Mm-hmm. So I don't care. It's my enjoyment. Mm-hmm. I want a clean piece that no one else has touched, mm-hmm. and here it is in my room. So I'm happy. And then there's other people who, for budget reasons, they can't afford either the really good vintage or the newly remanufactured iconic stuff, and so you get knockoffs, and you know, they're made in various countries, and you get them online or you get them into big box stores, and they rip off the ideas of the original designers. Mm-hmm. And for that, I say that's good too. You know, if that's what you could afford, if that's what gives you pleasure, if that completes your look of your house, mm-hmm. that's fine. You know, I'm not going to make a stand that you're cheating out the original designers of their commissions, mm-hmm. or their royalties. You know, it's true, but you know, I know that people are in different economic levels, and you know, pursue what makes you happy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would try not to buy a knockoff myself, but I don't look down on people who do.
Yeah.
You know, it's just economic necessity.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Jim Brown, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me. And you're at AtomicRanch.com?
Yes. With a hyphen. AtomicRanch.com.
Okay. Are you on any social media people should be watching for, anything like that?
We have Friends of Atomic Ranch magazine. There's two Facebook groups.
Okay.
It's pretty active. Mm-hmm. We don't do a whole lot. Personally, we don't do a whole lot. It's people sharing their stuff. You know, I just bought this house, or I'm looking at this house, or what do you think of my furniture? How should I paint things? And so it's a big community that's talking all the time. And there's two of them. One has an ish, just our logo, and the other an image. I don't know why. I don't know why we have two, but we have two. And, you know, it's a big, happy family.
Yeah. Cool. Well, listeners should watch for the 10th anniversary issue, which is probably might be out when they hear this.
It hits the stores March the 1st.
Oh, okay.
It's QFC, Powell's, Fred Meyer, bookstores, whatever, or, you know, go to our website.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Have a nice
day.
It's
been a pleasure. It's been a blast.
's talk about this record we've been playing a lot here.
Okay.
So we were at Jackpot Records downtown here, which is sadly closing.
They are.
That's what I heard.
That's a bummer.
And we bought The Slider by T-Rex, which mm-hmm. is a really good album. It's funny because I have this problem where sometimes I'll focus on, you know, like with T-Rex, it's like Electric Warrior is such a great album. It's definitely T-Rex's best album. Mm-hmm. And so I felt little motivation to seek out other albums. You know, like I'd heard a lot about the early work being really weird and not very accessible, and the later work being kind of like bloviating and dull.
Jesus.
But, well, they made a lot of albums. They made, you know, probably an album a year over at least a decade. But Slider holds up really well to Electric Warrior. Mm-hmm. It's a damn good album. You know, and I was especially noticing how much influence I hear from this album. That's the first thing I was noticing. I was start by reading everything I can online about the album while I'm listening to it, and then trying to figure out like where its influence has spread. You can laugh.
I'm laughing because I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm no Dan. Like, we're not going to do this.
You're no Dan. I'll have this conversation with Dan again later. But it's really good. I was glad that you picked it out.
Oh, good.
Because I would not have spontaneously plunked down $20 on an album that I really wasn't convinced was good, but I've fallen in love with it. Not only that, but I love when the record includes a digital download because it's a great album and it's nice to be able to listen to it at home too. Yeah. Or
you go into record purchasing with a lot of history.
Yeah.
And I think some baggage attached to that.
Right.
And I probably am more likely to go into it with I love this person's voice. I'd like to see what they did over here too, which is, I think I'm, you know, sometimes that ends up with some poor choices, but you know, sometimes it's a delight.
Yeah, it's ironically, I was more like you when I was working like coffee house jobs, where it's just like you leave, you have $50 of tips in your pocket, and what's the big deal of just buying some random record on the way home? But ironically, now that I'm like, I get a paycheck and stuff like that. Like it has to all come out of the bank, the same place that everything else comes out of, like my child's college fund. I actually are much more hesitant to make some spontaneous purchase.
Yeah.
Especially nowadays, you could listen to the whole album on, you know, Spotify or RDO or.
Would it help if you gave yourself like a record fund where
I essentially do that now. I essentially say I can just buy a record a week, but
yeah, and then you let go of that because you don't want to lose that sense of musical.
But the difference is you won't even watch. I'll start putting on a trailer like for a movie, and you'll be like, "Stop it! I just want to see the movie. I don't want to know anything about the plot. Like the trailer will ruin it."
Yeah,
but for me, it's like
you'll research every.
I'm like that with shows too. Yeah. Like, I will literally, like, go upstairs to get a drink and look up that episode that we're watching on Wikipedia.
Come on.
This is true. And I'll read how it ends just because I don't like waiting to find out how it ends. And I actually enjoy it more if I know, like, the production history of the movie and all sorts of details about it. I love knowing
the background. Do you know what I do enjoy, though, is that HBO... when you see an episode of Mad Men, which we, I think, subscribe to through iTunes?
Yes.
No, so that one's not HBO. Sorry. That's
AMC. Yeah.
They also put out the making of that episode.
Right, cool.
But see, I think you would probably watch that snippet first.
Yes,
I would. I watch the episode.
I'd watch it first. So I'd know what to look for when I watch the show.
Yeah, totally.
Like, I want to know. The plot for me just gets in the way of like delighting over the production and the intricacies of scenes and how they're shot, and you know, like with like, and I think that's why, like, if I like a movie like The Birds, like Hitchcock's The Birds, like I like the fact that I know how it ends and it doesn't matter how it ends. Like it's a solved problem in my head. I would rather every time I watch it, like, try to focus on something different, like the lighting or the... And when I listen to an album, I'll listen to it, like, easily 100 times. But each time I'll listen for some other detail, like the way that the singer, like, voices things, or the way that the drummer chooses to play certain fills. Like, I'll listen for every possible detail, and I'm always finding something new in the same song over and over.
But what about, I mean, so that's all well and good.
Thanks.
But what surprises me is that your first listen isn't pure. Like, wouldn't you want your first experience of something to just be your experience of it, not sort of clouded by all of that research and everything, but just, you know, one experience, purely yours.
Right.
And then after that, if you enjoyed it, whatever, go read about it. But take a moment to just be in that moment.
So this is sort of an existential problem that I have, as you would imagine, thought a ton about. Now, that first initial perfect listen, like, I'll listen to my favorite album and I'll think, I would imagine, like, how amazing this would be the first time I listened to it. But every single album that I think back, like, I think back to, like one of my favorite albums is, Bob Dylan, Bring It All Back Home. So it starts out with Subterranean Homesick Blues, which is a very drawly, Jan is in the basement. And I remember the first time I heard that, I hated it. I remember the first time I heard Doolittle by the Pixies. I thought it just sounded hellish, terribly produced, which it kind of is.
That's really your reaction to everything
right. The
first time.
But,
okay. All
but
right. Now
then,
we're getting
somewhere. I regrouped. I read a bunch of books on Dylan. I was like, God damn it, I'm going to like Bob Dylan. I'm going to learn everything about him. I know that he's one of, like, the heroes of the 60s, so I should like him. And I read all the stuff about him, and I, like, started at the beginning of his catalog, and then by the time I got to that album, I was like, this is great. This makes so much sense. Like, I could see why this was, like, then I have, like, a mental context for it, and, like, since then, I'm sure I've listened to that album 500 times, and it never gets old, but for me, I think the first listen is never good. Like, my first impressions of things are rarely positive ones. I'm usually, the first thing I notice is, like, every flaw. And then over time, I start to notice the beautiful, sublime details and texture and depth of it, you know. But there's no way you could see that on your first or even 10th listen or viewing. It takes a lot of time for me to really, it's like love.
I was just thinking about that. I was, like, thinking about our first meeting. Like, I wonder how hard that was.
Obviously, it was love at first sight, but wouldn't you rather have someone love you more and more over the years?
Yeah, no, I was focusing on that. I first noticed every flaw. Like, damn.
Well, it's good to get those out of the way.
I guess that, okay. So.
So anyway, T-Rex the Slider, Year I Was Born, great album. Nothing more to say.
I would agree.
See you guys next week.
Yeah.